From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Shortly after moving to Princeton, New Jersey back in 1984, Joyce Carol Oates began drafting a story based on the Victorian-era history of the area. And after setting the manuscript aside for 30 years, she has finished what has become a Gothic thriller called The Accursed. The novel combines portrayals of historical figures like Upton Sinclair and Woodrow Wilson with surreal and supernatural elements, including vampires, demons, and ghosts. We'll talk to the celebrated author about her new novel and her prolific career. That's next on Forum, after this. Carol Oates is a recipient of the National Medal of Humanities, the National Book Award, and the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction, and she was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. She's written some of the most enduring fiction of our time, including the national bestsellers We Were the Mulvaneys, Blonde, which was nominated for the National Book Award, and the New York Times bestseller The Falls, which we discussed on Forum. She's also Distinguished Professor of Humanities at Princeton, and her most recent novel, both a Gothic thriller and a historical novel, is called The Accursed. And she joins us for this Forum Hour. So good to have you back here. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
I should say, start off here, she's looking at a boxing book, which I brought for her by my friend Howard Schatz, who was featured here on Forum. Still love the sport, don't you?
Well, the sport is very interesting. I'm not even sure if it's a sport. It's something like a phenomenon. But these photographs by Howard Schatz are astonishing.
And in fact, I should mention that you've been writing about boxing for a number of years, off and on. Last time you were on with us, though, you talked about a widow's story, and I just wanted to catch people up. Your life has taken a decided turn.
Yes, I married Charlie Gross, a neuroscientist at Princeton University, in March 2009, and we're coming to an anniversary very soon.
Congratulations. And I've met Charlie. He's a great guy. I'm very happy for you. And you got a new book, and that's what we want to talk about here. It all takes place in Princeton, New Jersey. In fact, kind of the 30-year span. You started this book. You did a lot of research on Princeton where you'd been teaching, and then the book was kind of tucked away for three decades?
Well, I kept going back to the manuscript. I actually finished the first draft and was very excited about the story, the details, all the research I did into the history of the period. But I wasn't quite satisfied with the structure. I needed to rewrite it and trim it, make it shorter. The things that one does, you know, after a first draft, you have a kind of delirium of excitement with the first draft, and so much goes in and so much emotion. And then in a more calm period, you reread it and see that it really needs to be edited. It needs a different structure. Maybe it needs a slightly different prose style. And so it took me actually about three decades off and on reworking on it till finally in 2011 I rewrote it.
But it had to be rewritten from top to bottom?
Oh, yes. Well, that's great pleasure. I love to write. And if I could find a manuscript under a toadstool, let's say, I'd be just thrilled to have a manuscript that was already finished and then I would rewrite it. Doing a first draft is hard.
But this is a different kind of novel. I mean, you've done Gothic novels before. This is a Gothic novel, but it's also a historical novel. It kind of, I think, it's been called sort of a shape-shifting novel in the sense that it's multi-genre, or it's kind of a combination, synthesis
yes.
of genres.
Yes, it has a certain breadth and depth of scope. For a novel like that, you really have to plan it very carefully. I had a big wall, markers on the wall and a map of the area, a time graph, charts, genealogies. I had things on the wall because I had to keep looking up and make sure that people were living in the right houses and the right part of town. So the novel is both surreal, but it's rooted in historical reality. So it's a combination of both. It has dreamlike qualities, but it basically is about Princeton in 1905-06, and very much of it is historically real.
Well, you've got characters in there. It almost made me think of Doctorow, I mean, in the sense that you have these historical figures or a little bit of Oliver Stone, although I'd rather be compared to Doctorow, rather compare you to Doctorow, but the sense of using history and using actual historical figures, and Woodrow Wilson particularly, you get a very different sense of Woodrow Wilson in your novel. Obviously, you've done a lot of research about him. He's not exactly an admirable figure. And I thought of the irony of somebody like Glenn Beck, who's been blaming the whole progressive movement, going back to Woodrow Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson's a complex figure. He was controversial in his own time, and he's gone through a kind of ameliorizing process where with the decades, people's blemishes and failures sort of drop away, and they're held up in an iconic way. But then I think an advent of women's liberation and civil rights agitation, let's say, his reign has taken on a different coloration. We see that he was not really a leader. He was more someone who represented many of the bigoted beliefs of the time. He was extremely sexist. He was a racist. He wouldn't have come out and said these things, but by his actions, we can see that he was both a sexist and a racist.
And there's a lot about racism and sexism in this novel of yours. Even character Upton Sinclair, the great muckraker, comes off as much as perhaps you admire him or seem to admire him, respect the work he did, as a misogynist.
Well, I think Upton Sinclair isn't exactly a misogynist. He's somebody who married very young. He was very immature. His first marriage was to someone he had colonized, let's say. He had hoped that she'd be a socialist like himself, and she was also very young. We have to realize that these people were probably in their, really early 20s. And so I think that he had many good qualities. I liked Upton Sinclair's idealism and his hope of being able to change society by writing books. That's extremely idealistic.
Have you had some of that idealism with any of your work?
Oh, no, not really. I wouldn't conceive of having the ability to change a society. I think that's very, very rare. Harriet Beecher Stowe with Uncle Tom's Cabin is a sort of quintessential example of a novel that had a profound change, caused a profound change in society. But it's so rare. I mean, that's like one among many millions of works.
But your book has had impact on consciousness and on people's lives and certainly on the way they see the world and the world configures for them, all of those kinds of things. And that is difficult to measure, but it's there.
That's true. It's difficult to measure. I think of myself as a writer for individuals, as you say, maybe altering consciousness in an individual way. There are writers like Emily Dickinson who may have had a profound effect on individuals. That's very true. But as far as having a profound effect on society as a whole, that's something different. There's a whole type of literature that has existed and might exist again, but is quite rare.
And yet in this book there's a lot, as we said, about racism, sexism, about xenophobia and misogyny. And, I'm reminded of Barbara Kingsolver, who said that novels should have a social purpose. They should have a dimension that one can be instructed or learn from about social injustice, for example. And clearly that's part of your schema here, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. The novel is very much about social justice, the dream of social justice and the expression of liberation. The idea, which seems to us very contemporary, that we can only love one another if we're free. We're free to love one another. If a young woman is not free, if she's financially dependent upon her family, she's been brought up not to have a career, brought up to be a lady, and really brought up to be wed to some person, we can see in retrospect that she was never free. And then the kind of love that people feel in those circumstances is not a liberated love. So the novel is very much about the freeing of a younger generation. So at the end of the novel, the younger generation has sort of realigned itself. They've all left Princeton, and they've joined up with the socialist cause, which maybe is a gesture of idealism and naivete.
We don't want to give away too much here.
That's right.
Right. But that's right. It's also a novel about a curse. And it also has elements, you've often described yourself as a psychological novelist and a novelist who writes, notwithstanding some of the Gothic novels, realistic literature. This is a novel that takes a departure from that. I mean, we've got vampires, we've got Satan himself, we've got ghosts and so forth. And in that sense, I couldn't help thinking about the old debate between H.G. Wells and Henry James, you know, the saturation selection debate. You've got kind of a very wide canvas here. You're saturated with a lot of stuff.
Well, I was thinking of a society that was so enclosed and self-congratulatory and blind and placid, complacent and indifferent, this very affluent white Christian society of Princeton in 1905-06, and how that they were in a complete state of denial, particularly about the terrible treatment of African Americans, whom they called Negroes, and many of them were their own servants. These leaders, these Christian leaders, were guilty of the sin of indifference or cowardice, not speaking up against racism. The Ku Klux Klan was being formed. I think the Ku Klux Klan may not actually have been formed so soon in New Jersey, maybe in the 1920s. But the Ku Klux Klan and similar racist groups were lynching Negroes and terrorizing Negroes in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and elsewhere. It wasn't just in the South. And the white leaders, Christian churchmen, really didn't say anything. You know, they could have had a powerful influence on their congregations, but they just didn't say anything. So the novel's about the curse of that kind of cowardice, that kind of indifference. And I felt, too, in writing the novel, that the white ruling class tacitly agreed with the racists, that there was this taboo subject of miscegenation. They just did not want their beautiful young blonde daughters to be marrying black men. That would be the taboo that nobody would speak of aloud. So there are elements in the novel that deal with the unspeakable, the taboo that can't be spoken of. And another one is gay love. Homosexual love could not be spoken of. It could not be named.
The love that dare not speak its name.
That's right. It could not be named.
This is 1905, 1906. Should we look back historically and maybe give some of these white patriarch Christians a little bit of slack like we do Jefferson, who was a slave owner because of the times that they lived in?
Well, that's a debatable issue. I'm not sure. There were other people who were courageous, like Mark Twain. I mean, some people were speaking out. The Princeton Theological Seminary was a conservative bastion. And they were proud of the fact, and this is a direct quote I got from history. They were proud of the fact that, quote, no new ideas will emerge from the seminary. In other words, they were proud and they boasted, and it was a promise that no new ideas would come from Princeton.
And this, we should add, was when Woodrow Wilson was the president of Princeton.
That's when Woodrow
became the president of the United States.
That's right. That's right. So Woodrow Wilson himself was something of a reformer. He reformed the university curriculum. As I said, he's a complex figure. But I was so struck by the fact that somebody would be so conservative and bigoted and proud to promise that no ideas will come from the source. However, Princeton in 2013 is very different. And the university where I've been teaching for several decades is completely different from Woodrow Wilson's university. So I hope people understand that there's a century. There's more than a century difference.
Does teaching sometimes, I mean, because of the time that it consumes, but also because you think in a different way pedagogically or academically or even scholarly, does it interfere with your creation of fiction?
No, not at all. I assign classic works of literature to my students, and we go over the stories. They're all short stories. Very carefully. We did last week a Paul Bowles story. Week before, we did a story by Jack London. We'll be doing a story by John Updike this
week. Updike story, yeah. Just curious. Because
it's called The Persistence of Desire, which is a lovely story. And Jack London's story is in a far country. And the students got so much out of it, and the students are very sharp. These are my UC Berkeley students. I'm teaching at Berkeley this term. And they're really sharp, enthusiastic readers. They read a long, rather demanding story by Annie Proulx called The Mud Below. It's almost like a little novel. And I was thinking, the story's so long. When I reread it, I thought, oh, the students will feel this is too long. But on the contrary, they really liked it. And several of them spoke of it in the most interesting and illuminating terms. So I find the teaching really rejuvenating.
Talking with Joyce Carol Oates, her new novel is called The Accursed, and she is indeed here in the Bay Area. We're talking about just the effect of the novel, and I remember for some reason in reading The Accursed, thinking about Kaczynski, of all people, Jerzy Kaczynski, because there was a way that he felt that his literature could not only capture the imagination, but it could get inside of one, almost spook one. And you're writing about these kind of demonic forces. And I want to talk a little bit more about that curse, because I see it in a metaphoric way, too. I see it almost like Faulknerian, in the sense that, you know, slavery became a curse that lasted for centuries in Faulkner's
yes.
mind. And I think that's working in yours. But you're also really getting into the reader's internal life.
Well, I would hope to do that. And my writing also deals with class struggle, pretty much. And I see vampires, a sort of iconic vampires. I don't see in a romantic way. I see that they're exemplary of one class preying upon another class.
They become kind of romanticized through all the popular culture now, though. You know?
They in the popular culture today. But I think the original idea is that Dracula was a wealthy landowner.
Yes. Bram Stoker's Dracula, yeah.
Yeah, and he was, it's a symbol of preying upon the proletariat or the peasants, literally sucking their blood. The nobleman is sucking the blood of the people. That's, to me, the parable of the vampire.
And the parable of Satan? I mean, you've always compared yourself to Hawthorne, and I think that comparison is valid. Here we meet the devil.
Well, we meet some manifestation of something demonic. I'm not sure that it's the devil himself. Maybe the devil has emissaries. You know, the idea of Satan with a small letter S, there are many Satans, like little demons. Mm-hmm. The idea that there's only one Satan, that's just an idea.
They're like Dybbuks.
They're kind of running around.
Talking again with Joyce Carol Oates. And I'm wondering, too, about how much research went into this novel, because it seems to me that it's considerable. And there are many things, you know, that I learned, for example, about some of the historical figures in this novel that I had no idea about. I mean, it's pretty impressive research, if I may say.
Like Jack London?
Like Jack London, yeah, but also Woodrow Wilson.
Yes. Well, I'm from his hometown, so to speak, the Princeton University Library has a lot of material.
What did you want people to learn about, well, London, for example?
Jack London?
Yeah.
Well, it was more like the encounter between Upton Sinclair, the young, naive, hopeful socialist, and Jack London, the slightly older but already jaundiced and sort of decadent.
Cynical, almost, really.
Cynical. Yeah. And he was still a socialist, but in his mouth it had become cliched and kind of mocking. He would give these speeches when he was drunk, and he would say the same things about idealism of the socialist revolution, and yet it all came out as if it was something very debased.
Like boilerplate.
Yeah. And then he died not long after then. He died an alcoholic's death, or perhaps he committed suicide. But it was the encounter between the slightly younger Upton Sinclair and the slightly older Jack London that was really very, very interesting to me.
That made me think of Doctorow, too, because he would bring historical figures into encounters, sometimes fictionalizing them, of course, but also using the historic that he was able to research.
Well, you speak of Ed Doctorow, but, you know, before him was Dos Passos.
Yes.
And I think USA, I think Dos Passos is the person that Ed Doctorow looked at. You know, it wasn't, a doctor didn't invent this. It was basically something that was sort of...
Although a lot of those historical figures in USA, in Dos Passos' work, they're
flat.
Not necessarily in the fiction. They're in those periscopes or kaleidoscopes.
The sort of flat headlines. But the idea of mixing history and fiction goes back to Shakespeare. I think it's
And tell me about where M.W. Van Wyck, sorry, Van Dyck, it's the D-Y-C-K that threw me, the second came from. I mean, he's the historian. He's your source.
Well, in a novel like this that has a lot of historical detail set in the past, it's helpful to have a narrator who's not the author. So you have a frame in which somebody's telling the story. This person's done a lot of research. Like many historians, he's found special archives, and he has his own notebooks. He has like 12 special notebooks that nobody else has seen, and he claims that he has some information that nobody else has, and evidently he does. So Van Dyck is a descendant of a family in the area. Many of the old wealthy landowning families in Princeton are preserved, and the names are preserved in streets and buildings.
And was there an Adelaide Barr, the journal writer that you, or did you create her out of whole cloth?
Well, I created her, yes.
So I just wondered.
I was
about,
very sympathetic with her.
And the Slade family was also created by you?
Yes, but I know where they live. These are all streets that I drive on in Princeton all the time. But the idea of the invalid in 19th century fiction, of course, this is early 20th century, but the female invalid, she's taken to her bed because she does not want to be a woman or a wife or a mother in that world. I mean, initially, the first reward that you get for being an invalid in the morning, you don't have to put on your whalebone corset. And if you had to put it on, let's say if a man had to put on this horrible thing, he would understand immediately the lure of the sick bed. So the invalid woman does not have to put on this horrible corset and have like an 18-inch waist. Then the other reward for being an invalid is that you would not have to be a mother. You wouldn't have to have babies. And many women were terrified of being pregnant, having children. Many women died in childbirth. This was the era, you know, when doctors did not wash their hands. It was not considered anything you needed to do. You didn't wash your hands of all these teeming germs in helping a mother give birth. So many women died in childbirth, or they suffered considerably, and many infants died. So it wasn't a romantic era as far as that was concerned, and that's why there were so many invalids. And then some women had babies. Some women had 11, 12, 13 babies, and they became real invalids, and they were just sort of lying in their beds. And they were not necessarily older women. They were just worn out physically.
Our guest, Joyce Carol Oates, her new novel is called The Accursed. Let me open our phone lines and ways that you can communicate with one of the nation's leading authors who is spending the hour with us here in studio. And you can call us if you have questions or comments for her. If you'd like to join the program and the conversation, we do welcome your calls. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free from wherever or however you're listening to Forum, 866-733-6786. You will be appearing tonight, by the way, 7:30 at Herb Theater as part of the City Arts and Lectures. I think you'll be interviewed by Bob Hass, in fact.
Yes, that should be wonderful.
Other ways to communicate with us, email forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum, and please feel free to join the program. We welcome your calls and emails. Joyce Carol Oates with us. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Shortly after moving to Princeton, New Jersey back in 1984, Joyce Carol Oates began drafting a story based on the Victorian era history of the area, and after setting the manuscript aside for some 30 years, she finished what has become a gothic thriller, The Accursed. The novel combines portrayals of historical figures, as we've been saying, like Upton Sinclair and Woodrow Wilson, with surreal elements, including vampires and demons and ghosts. And we're talking with the celebrated author about her new novel. And we certainly welcome your involvement in the program. If you have been a reader of Joyce Carol Oates, or if you would like to join this conversation or have questions or comments for her, we welcome your involvement. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us on Facebook or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @kqedforum. And you can always, of course, also go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and just click on the segment. You believe in curses?
Curses?
Yeah.
Well, I believe in some sort of psychological curse, that if you have committed an act, that you're really deeply ashamed of and should be ashamed of, and you don't make reparation for it, I think it will come back as some kind of a curse with quotation marks around it. I mean, there will be consequences. It's the American curse was, as you said a few minutes ago, slavery. And the slavery...
And taking land from the Native Americans.
Exactly. And it comes back as a curse in some modified way or some transmogrified way.
Individual curses with people who, I mean, aren't you talking about people who are haunted by guilt and so forth? There are some sociopaths who feel none of that.
I think that's true. There are sociopaths, psychopaths who may not feel guilt. But on the contrary, there are some other people who feel an excess of guilt. They're haunted by things that they probably didn't even really do. And that's almost more common.
Or realize the consequences of.
Yeah, I mean, I know many people who are extremely good, conscience-stricken people. They feel guilty for things that they probably don't need to feel guilty about. You know, it's the opposite. And then there are many returning veterans from the Iraqi war, the Afghanistan war, for instance, who come back and physiologically they may be damaged, but psychologically they're even more damaged. And because they've seen things or they maybe have done things or they participated in things that they didn't necessarily want to do, but they participated in involuntarily, and they're haunted by those images. And as we know, we read about this all the time. And my next novel is actually about that subject.
Got another one underway.
Well, the next novel is a realistic novel set in a small upstate New York City. It's called Carthage, and that's an examination, or you could say, demons coming back to haunt a young Iraqi war veteran who actually, when you look into it, he's not really that guilty, but he participated in a larger action where other soldiers were doing things that were very vile. But to what extent are you guilty when you participate in an action that you did not initiate? You know, it's sort of a subtle psychological thing because you failed to stop it, but maybe you couldn't stop it. Or you failed to speak out against it. Well, maybe there wasn't the opportunity. But you don't necessarily condone it, but yet you may come back from the event quite wounded and quite stricken with guilt. And so I'm thinking that the whole American adventure in wars is something like that, that there is a residue, like the Vietnam War for some generation, like Bob Stone, Robert Stone, and Tim O'Brien and others, the Vietnam War is still with us. You know, it's still being played out in different ways. It didn't just end. It's still somehow a living presence.
Talking again with Joyce Carol Oates, the author of The Accursed. We're going to go to your calls and emails in just a moment here. Since you've been so prolific, and your prolificity is often commented on by people who have followed your career, I mean, we're not only talking about fiction, gothic fiction, realistic fiction, a whole array of and range of short stories and novels, but also essays and written poetry through the years, reviews and so forth. What do you tell people who say they suffer from writer's block?
Oh, well, sometimes people do ask me about that. I'm not sure that there is such a thing as writer's block. At least, as I said when somebody asked me about it, I said writer's block, it's a very expensive area, real estate, probably in Park Slope, Brooklyn. In other words, there is a block of writers,
yes.
And that's where they live in Park Slope, Brooklyn. It's very expensive. But as for there being some sort of real writer's block psychologically, I think it's sort of a fiction.
Since you mentioned Park Slope, I've got to just ask another question, because you lived for many years outside of Detroit, and now you've been at Princeton all these years. There really is a writer's community around that area of Brooklyn. I mean, young writers.
Oh, yes, very much.
Many of whom we've featured on this program, and they they seem symbiotic and feed off each other and so forth.
They're wonderful.
But then there's the argument, you know, Faulkner used to say, second time I mentioned Faulkner, I didn't realize I'd be talking about him with you, but used to talk about the fact that, you know, he was down there in Mississippi and there was no writer's community, and he felt that his isolation served him better than being connected to all those other writers?
Well, William Faulkner's great subject was Oxford, the area around Oxford, and what he created as Yoknapatawpha County. That was his subject. So for him to be there and sort of be steeped in the history and tall tales and things he would hear from his neighbors, that was very, very important to him. However, Faulkner did often come to New York City, and he did go to Los Angeles.
But he didn't have the other writers or artists around him like many New York writers do, or many writers in even Los Angeles and San Francisco.
No, but Faulkner was a great genius. He was also quite a serial alcoholic, as you know. He had some writer friends, but painters have always had their friends, and they visit one another's studios. And for painters in Paris, particularly in Paris and elsewhere in France, that's very important in New York City.
Well, you've had long friendships with people like Russell Banks, for example. I know.
Yes. I don't read any of my friends' work in manuscript, and they don't read mine. But I think that artists go and visit each other's studios, and they see works in progress. And it's always been very helpful and very exciting, I think, for artists. For poets, it's a little different. Poets do send their work to one another because the poems are short enough. Robert Lowell, for instance, people will be surprised to hear that. The great Robert Lowell really showed his poems to many of his poet friends.
Wasn't Elizabeth Bishop a student of his, and he wound up sending them to her?
Was she a student? Well, she was certainly a very close friend.
I think
friend.
She may have been a student, but yeah.
She was a very close friend, and they were certainly equals. Yeah, they showed each other their work, particularly he showed her his work. Novelists do much less of that because, for one thing, the novel is just too long.
Let's go to your calls, and we begin, Stanley, with you. Good morning.
Hello. Ms. Oates, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. We in the audience are very grateful. I was wondering, in your studies, did you come across the notion of the burden bearer, as some of the secret societies supposedly will take all of this negative energy or whatever from years of what some people would call sorcery in their families, and they tend to put it on one person who ends up in an asylum and is either, you know, driven crazy or held kind of against his will. Did you run across this sort of stuff?
Oh, that sounds so fascinating. No, I've never heard that. It's psychologically akin to the idea of scapegoating. I guess you find some object for your repressed, the negative things in your own life that have been repressed. The burden bearer, one person in a family who becomes the repository of these various things. No, I didn't come across that. I was really doing research into actual historical people in the Princeton.
Did you also run into, in your vampire studies, the bacteria that it supposedly causes vampire-like symptoms that is also found in that area of Europe?
Oh, really? No, but I didn't do research into what's called the Jersey Devil. There are a lot of folk tales and lurid tall tales about the Jersey Devil. No, that's really interesting. It's fascinating.
Supposedly this bacteria will, you know, make your skin crawl in the presence of sunlight,
wow.
Garlic, and things.
Interesting.
Things like this, yes.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Fascinating. Well, you have to write your own novel. That sounds great.
You've just been encouraged to write a novel by Joyce Carol Oates.
It sounds really good, and I haven't done any of those things, so it's completely fresh.
Thank you. And Mark from Berkeley writes, I was interested in Miss Oates' analysis of vampires as class entitled Bloodsuckers. I see in the modern Twilight phenomenon a similar parable of cultured ultra-white vampires versus working-class darker werewolves. Does Miss Oates have any thoughts off the top of her head as to why the current cultural movement is so interested in the idea of beleaguered humans versus zombies?
Oh, I think that's a fascinating subject, and I really would need time to think about it and really analyze it. It's extremely interesting. I don't know the adolescent vampire literature and the movies. I haven't seen them. But the werewolves, I suppose, are more like proletariat. They're more like dogs or animals.
Colson Whitehead wrote a novel about zombies, actually.
I know he did, but I haven't read it yet. I would guess it was probably a symbolic novel. Colson's got his... Colson's very funny.
He is funny. He's charming. Yeah, he's talented. Enjoy having him on. He's been on a number of times.
He's very ironic. So if he has zombies, they have some symbolic burden.
Do you know about his remark to Richard Ford?
What was that?
Richard Ford, and it gets me to another question about how you respond sometimes to reviews, but Richard Ford, many years later, after a bad review was written of one of his novels by Colson, of a collection of short stories, by Colson Whitehead, came up to him and literally spit on him. Now, this is a white Southerner spitting on a black man, you know, which in itself
Right, I've
is,
heard about that.
Well, but yeah. Colson, you talk about how funny Colson is. Colson said, next time I have to see Richard Ford in any social situation, I'll wear a raincoat and galoshes.
That was an unfortunate incident. I've heard different impressions of the encounter that Richard spat toward his feet. But even so, it's very
Ford
dramatic.
It's
extreme.
Yeah. I'll tell you my own war stories with Richard Ford.
Piece of work?
Yeah.
Piece of work?
Is that a piece of work?
I always wonder what that expression meant, a piece of work. But if you say Richard Ford's a piece of work, then I'm coming to understand it.
Well, Christopher writes, I don't know about Woodrow Wilson's time, but understand that at present the seminary is totally independent of the university. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think it was probably independent of the university at this time. This is a long time ago, and both institutions were quite small.
Another listener writes, I love Miss Oates on boxing, which is so succinct and yet holds so many universes of perspectives which one would not really associate with the then middle-aged white female writer and academic who wrote it, such empathy for people different from her, and it was possibly not really a popular subject given her audience. Was Oates' on boxing an overlooked landmark in feminist writing for a white female academic to write so thoughtfully about athletes who were always male and almost always poor and minorities? Sure seemed like a big deal, or should have been. At the time, it seems like most feminists of any color, were mainly exploring female characters and subjects. The way she tied in the significance of Joe Louis to the black community in one anecdote, I'd read many books on boxers, all by men, but no one cracked the story and got at the meat as concisely as Oates.
Well, it certainly was never lauded as a feminist work. That's an interesting perspective. I wrote it because of my love of boxing and boxing's significance in American history, and also because my father took me to boxing matches when I was quite young, and my father was good friends with a professional boxer who came to a disastrous end and ultimately committed suicide. So for me, boxing is a very rich and complex and contradictory symbol. It means many different things. It can mean triumph, but can also mean tragedy.
Michael writes on our Facebook page, Ishmael Reed implied or maybe even stated in one of his novels, Last Days of Louisiana, read that Woodrow Wilson's stroke was actually a voodoo curse. I'm looking forward to reading Miss Oates' book.
Yeah. Wow, very interesting. Well, he had several strokes. He had his first stroke when he was only 39. And he may have been just mildly or more than mildly paranoid. He may have been, you know, the after effects of a stroke. And his paranoid delusion sort of fed into the ideas of the white ruling class, the fear of Negroes, the fear of the black people among them, though they were their own servants, and they liked their servants, you know, they needed their servants, they condescended and were completely dependent upon their own servants, and yet in the aggregate, they were frightened of and seemed to hate black people. That's the irony.
It was also, I'm thinking about Benito Cereno, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Melville's tale, and I'm thinking of it because there's also just tremendous ignorance about black people. You know, there was never, Amasa Delano in that short novel of Melville's couldn't believe that blacks could actually take over and rebel and take over a white sailing ship from Spain.
Yeah,
they didn't have the intelligence. They were more like Newfoundland dogs or something.
Yeah,
like
that's a good point, too. Yes, it's always been, the ruling classes have always been surprised sometimes to their dismay by their so-called opponents. And sometimes the Native Americans really beat the European settlers, you know. Sometimes there just weren't the numbers. There's a tale of Robert Frost's great-great-great-grandfather who may have come to America in the 17th century. He invited some Indians to have dinner with him or have a banquet, and he killed them. He killed them all. And then later on, Indians from that tribe killed him in a very picturesque manner. And that sort of seems like the quintessential tale, you know, of the Thanksgiving dinner and then the aftermath.
Have you read Toni Morrison's Mercy? She's a colleague of yours, I think. Still, isn't she teaching at Princeton?
I haven't read Mercy. I read Beloved.
Because Mercy, well, Beloved is also
Mercy.
You know,
that's the one. Is that the one set with the women?
Yes.
All women. Oh, yes, I have read that.
Well,
all women.
Again, the curse even begins before the Republic was established. It goes all the way back. I mean, in terms of the way it's portrayed in that novel. But I've got another caller here, and let's go to you, Neil. Good morning.
Yes, I was wondering if you ever heard of William Kunstler's book, The Minister or the Choir Singer, in which he alleges that the two people in that scandal were murdered by the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh, yes, I have. I wrote about that. I wrote about a version of that in Mysteries of Winterturn. That's a very well-known, supposedly unsolved mystery in the New Brunswick, New Jersey area. Yes, I'm sure it may have been the Klan.
Thank you, Neil. Diane writes, Mud Woman. I love this book. Can't put it down. You are a wonderful writer. Mud Woman is so very interesting. Thank you for all your writings.
Wow, that's really nice. Thank you.
Another listener, Frank, says, Miss Oates seems like such a somber person who deals only in dark subjects. What makes her laugh?
Well, I actually do have a sense of humor, and The Accursed...
I can attest to that.
The Accursed has many funny things in it. It's, in a way, it's a comedy of manners. It's much more a comedy of people behaving in ignorant ways and being punished for the behavior. A comedy of manners, looking at society. Yeah, I like humor very much. I like Jon Stewart and I like Stephen Colbert very much. They're examples of humor.
Are you drawn to the so-called dark humor, though? He talks about the darkness in your work. I mean, it used to be called black humor, gallows humor. We think about Nathaniel West and writers like Pynchon and Bruce J. Friedman, Vonnegut, a whole slew of American writers, yeah.
Well, I suppose so.
It's not your necessarily métier, though, or not something you're drawn to, is it?
Oh, I don't know how to answer that. It depends on the humor. I do have a lot of surrealist humor, I think, in my writing. Maybe people don't notice it. There are funny things in Mud Woman. I mean, they're obviously funny things, but I think when people read it, they think that it's more somber. I mean, there are absurd. There's the comedy of absurdity engages me.
Yeah, well, that comes across in your work. And again, the newest work by Joyce Carol Oates is The Accursed. And if you'd like to talk to her in the time remaining, it's 866-733-6786. Douglas asks by email, and you can also email us, forum@kqed.org. I'd be curious to hear Miss Oates' comments about Upton Sinclair's Lanny Budd novels, which I was introduced to in Africa and have read every one. You know them?
No, I haven't. I read about them, and I read about Upton Sinclair's Great Hope for the transformation of society. I had once taught The Jungle, and the students responded to that in very interesting ways. I was teaching it as propaganda. The Lanny Budd novels, I assume, are autobiographical, but I haven't read them.
Here's Danica, who says, I'm a recent graduate of UC Berkeley's English department. I've also worked with the Prison University Project at San Quentin State Prison, where Joyce Carol Oates taught a creative writing class a few springs ago. She subsequently published a piece entitled San Quentin and her portrayal of the main character, an inmate in a college-level introduction to biology class, outraged many of the men I know within San Quentin's educational department for its perpetuation of inmates as subhuman. I would like to hear Miss Oates speak about how she views her responsibility when portraying individuals, especially with regards to sensitive populations like the incarcerated.
Well, I certainly didn't present these characters as subhuman. One person was one narrator was the teacher who was insecure and out of his element. It was not based on any real person. And the other was an inmate who had a tragic past who was trying to contend with it. And I thought, to me, to me, both voices were treated with much respect. But I guess if you don't say completely positive things about people, I guess it's just the idea of people not being familiar with what literature is. I can create a character I consider complex but deep, and I can feel very sympathetic toward him. Somebody else might say, "Oh, that's not a flattering portrait," but I can't really, as a serious writer, create a flattering portrait. And if somebody is incarcerated for having committed murder, to me that is a fact, and you can't pretend that this is a choir boy.
Christine writes, there is another less superstitious and sensational term for the consequences of actions about which Ms. Oates spoke, memory. One would be remiss as well not to point out that kind actions, unthinking actions, all actions have consequences. I tend to experience much more pain for things which are meant to be helpful or kind because no good deed goes unpunished. Ms. Oates is brilliant, but I'm disappointed to hear her fetishize the experience of guilt. When one ascribes superstitious notions like a curse to slavery, even metaphorically, it's to inoculate a real historical injustice from genuine ethical scrutiny.
Well, I don't even know what that means. I don't think I'm really that simple-minded that I believe in a curse with a quotation marks around it, so that
formidable question. You believe in evil? You believe there are diabolical forces and demonic forces that exist among us?
No, I think those are theological terms. I'm not sure that they're helpful. If you look upon life in more of a, from a scientific perspective, you would see there's rapacity and hunger, great appetite, a yearning for territory where people are colonizing weaker people or pillaging or raping or killing to take over their territory, which they would maybe feel was a kind of manifest destiny, but the objects of their pillage would think that they were evil, or they would feel that they were fulfilling their destiny. I think evil, good and evil, are sort of theological terms.
And yet, when we speak about certain kinds of aggression, we were talking, for example, in the first segment about this baby born in rural Mississippi that actually was cured of HIV. They believe it was cured of HIV, which is extraordinary. But also talking about all of the AIDS victims, say, in a place like the Congo because of rape, and rape used as essentially a political means of subjugation. It's called evil, I mean, even without theology attached to it.
Well, it's a word. I mean, I wouldn't say it was... Personally, the word evil seems to suggest a force outside individual responsibility. Like if the devil made me do it, or I heard voices, and there's evil in the world. Raping and killing other people was not invented in the Congo. I mean, this is part of the human species.
John joins us next. John, you're on. Hi, good morning.
Thank you. I was wondering if Ms. Oates has heard of what I think of as a subtly gothic psychological contemporary novel called Your Presence is Requested at Suvanto.
No, I haven't heard of that. Sounds so interesting.
It's very interesting. It takes place in a sanatorium in Finland. And
wow.
It's about what motivates these American women to go there for help. And her name is Miley Chapman. It's the author.
Sounds fascinating.
Yeah, well, thank you for that recommendation.
Yeah, that's great.
I think I just discovered maybe why I mentioned Faulkner twice, plumbing my own unconscious. I remember reading years and years ago an article about you and the Gothic, and it tried to link you essentially to the Southern writers of the United States. It took that sort of thesis that maybe you, without even realizing it, had come out of some sort of Southern Gothic, zeitgeist maybe.
Well, it's possible. People, I think academic people always trying to trace influences. However, I would probably be a writer anyway. And maybe the Southern Gothic is descended from Edgar Allan Poe.
Who was a big influence on you, yes?
Well, he was sort of an influence. I've been greatly influenced by James Joyce, actually.
The Ulysses or the short stories? Or
short stories.
The Dubliners.
James Joyce. I mean, and Ulysses, yes.
Judy writes, Miss Oates wrote a short story that I read fairly recently in The New Yorker about a young girl whose mother was probably killed by her husband, the father of the girl, and I was very shocked by the callous treatment she received by the police and social workers. This story should be required reading for police, social workers dealing with children and adolescents.
Well, thank you, but one of the police women in the story is quite kind. She's kind to the girl. I did want to show that one person was kind. And that story is based partly on some historic events in Atlantic City. of women who were found murdered, raped and murdered in an area behind some motel. And they were obviously prostitutes, and nobody seemed to care about them, and they were often not identified. So I thought, what would it be like to be the daughter of one of these women who was not identified? So the title of the story is ID, and the girl is supposed to make the identification.
The two stories that still remain probably most identifiable to readers of yours, especially who read you in an academic setting, are where are you going, where have you been, and the one about the girl who writes her essay for how she...
Yes.
In a detention home and all that. Joyce Carol Oates is professor in the humanities with the program in creative writing at Princeton. She's also teaching at UC Berkeley this semester, and she's the author of numerous works, including Them, which won the National Book Award in 1969, and Blonde, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in 2000. And she will be appearing tonight at 7:30 at the Herbst Theater as part of City Arts and Lectures with Bob Hess. Always good to have you aboard here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated in the evening. You can always continue to carry on a conversation by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.